You know, I was driving over a bridge the other day, just staring at the steel girders, and I had this thought. We tend to think of metal steel, specifically as, well, the most static things in our universe. You build a bridge, you forge a sword, and it just sits there. It's solid. It's done.
It's the very definition of permanence in our minds, right? Strong as steel.
Exactly. But then I started reading the research you sent over for today, and I realized that if you zoom in way, way down to the atomic level, that piece of static steel is actually a chaotic dance floor.
It really is. Atoms are constantly rearranging, shuffling, and engaging in this intense tug of war between different structures.
It's never really resting.
Never. Even when it looks solid to us, there is a war of thermodynamics happening inside. It's dynamic. And sometimes that war leaves scars that we can see under a microscope.
And today, we are diving into one of the most famous battles in that war. We're talking about the mystery of Bainite.
Ugh, bainite. The microstructure that launched 1,000 papers. It's a specific formation in steel that has caused, I think, more heated arguments in faculty lounges than perhaps any other topic in metallurgy.
Seriously, the Bainite controversy is legendary. People pick sides. And to understand why, and to maybe settle the score, we are going to look at a classic piece of detective work. We're deep diving into a 1982 paper by HKDH Padacia titled Bainite: Mobility of the Transformation Interface.
It's a dense title, I'll give you that. But the mission behind it is actually quite simple. We are trying to figure out how a specific boundary moves. Does the interface between the old metal and the new structure glide like a disciplined military unit, or does it climb like a chaotic construction crew?
It's the difference between a synchronized march and a messy scramble. And here's the kicker, and why I love this specific paper. To find the answer, this researcher didn't just run a test for an hour. He didn't run it for a day. He ran an experiment that lasted 43 days.
43 days. Holding a piece of metal at exactly 478 degrees Celsius, watching and waiting, just to see what would happen when the atoms finally got tired of waiting.
That is a level of patience I just do not possess.
Yeah.
So let's unpack this. We have this mystery structure, Bainite. Why is it so hard to figure out how it forms? Why is there even a debate?
It really comes down to geometry. Imagine you have a box filled with oranges packed in a specific way. That's your parent metal, which we call austenite. The crystal structure is face-centered cubic, or FCC. It's a very, dense way to pack atoms.
Okay, FCC. Oranges packed tight. Got it.
Right. Now, you want to turn that into ferrite, or bainite.
Yeah.
But these structures are body-centered cubic, or BCC. The packing is different.
Yeah.
The oranges don't line up the same way. It's a looser structure.
So you're trying to force a square peg into a round hole, or I guess a dense cube into a loose cube.
Exactly. You cannot join these two crystal lattices perfectly. They are misfits. If you try to glue a sheet of FCC to a sheet of BCC, the atoms at the boundary just won't match up. You'll have gaps or atoms crashing into each other.
So how does the metal solve this? It can't just leave a void.
It uses what we call an interface containing discontinuities or dislocations. Think of it like a zipper on a jacket where the teeth don't quite match. To keep it zipped, you have to skip a tooth every few inches.
Okay, the skip tooth is the dislocation.
Right. This is called a semi-coherent interface. It fits mostly, but with these periodic defects to make up for the geometric mismatch.
Okay, I'm with you. We have a zipper that skips teeth to make the mismatched fabrics fit. But this is where the fight starts, right? Because we need to move that zipper to grow the bainite.
Precisely. The debate is about how that zipper moves. There are two proposed mechanisms, and they represent completely different physical realities. Mechanism A is the glissile interface.
Glissile. It sounds like glide.
That's exactly what it is. It's a conservative motion. The interface glides smoothly. The atoms shift in a coordinated, sort of military fashion. They don't switch neighbors. The whole lattice just shears over. When this happens, it changes the shape of the material. We call this an invariant plane strain, or IPS.
So if I'm looking at the metal under a microscope and it glides, I should see a physical shape change, like an upheaval on the surface.
Yes, a relief.
Yeah.
But then there's mechanism B. This is the sessile or epitaxial interface. In this version, those mismatched dislocations, they can't just glide. They are stuck. To move, they have to climb.
Climb. That sounds exhausting.
It is, energetically speaking. It means individual atoms have to physically diffuse, detach, jump from one spot to another, and reattach to let the interface move forward. It requires heat or thermal activation. It's messy. It's non-conservative.
So mechanism A is a coordinated glide. Mechanism B is a messy shuffle requiring heat.
Correct. Now, for a long time, the conventional wisdom was simple. If you see a shape change, it must be the glider. If the surface stays flat, it must be the climber. Because if atoms are diffusing all over the place climbing, that random movement should, you know, wash out any sharp geometric shifts.
That seems logical.
Right.
So why didn't that settle the debate in, like, 1950?
Because the climb camp found a loophole. Hedaysia notes this in the paper. Some theorists argued that if the bainite plate is very thin relative to its length, the diffusion might not be enough to completely wash out the shape change.
Ah, so looking for a shape change isn't enough proof anymore. The climb camp said, hey, we can make shapes too, theoretically.
Exactly. They muddied the waters. So we were stuck. We couldn't tell if it was gliding or climbing just by looking at the surface relief. We needed a different way to catch the culprit.
And that brings us to the speed trap.
The speed trap. If we can't judge by the shape, we have to judge by the speed.
I love this setup. So walk us through the experiment. What exactly did Padaysia cook up to measure this?
He needed a very specific alloy recipe to control the variables. He used iron with 0.30% carbon and 4.08% chromium.
Why that specific mix? Is the chromium doing something special?
The chromium is there. It's there to slow down the kinetics so we can actually observe things. And the carbon is the key player in the transformation. He heated this alloy up to 1100 degrees Celsius to turn it all into austenite. That's our starting point. Then he rapidly cooled it down to 478 degrees Celsius.
478 degrees. Why that number?
That's the isotherm. It's the sweet spot for this specific alloy. At that temperature, the austenite is unstable. It desperately wants to turn into bainite. And initially, it does. The bainite plates grow very, very fast.
Okay, so the reaction starts. The military unit, or the scramble, whichever it is, starts moving, but then it stops.
It hits a wall. This is a phenomenon called stasis, or the incomplete reaction phenomenon. You see, as bainite forms, it's a bit of a picky eater. It creates a body-centered cubic structure, which really doesn't like holding onto carbon atoms. There's just no room for them.
So it kicks them out.
It rejects them. As the crystal structure changes, it pushes the excess carbon atoms out into the remaining austenite.
So the leftovers, the austenite, get richer and richer in carbon.
Exactly. And carbon stabilizes austenite. Eventually, the remaining austenite is so full of carbon that it becomes thermodynamically impossible for it to turn into bainite. The chemical push just drops to zero.
So the reaction chokes on its own exhaust. The carbon buildup stops the show.
Right. The reaction freezes. Now, in a normal experiment, a researcher might say, okay, reaction over, the austenite stable, let's write the paper.
But not Padaysia. He looked at that frozen metal and said, I don't trust you.
He suspected that the interface wasn't dead, just dormant. He wanted to see what would happen if he gave the atoms enough time to move via diffusion. Remember, at 478 degrees, diffusion is possible, but it is incredibly slow.
So he kept the furnace on. He held that sample at 478 degrees Celsius, right at that stasis point, for 43 days.
43 days. Just keeping the temperature stable for that long is a challenge in itself, but he waited.
And what happens to steel when you leave it in the oven for a month and a half? Did it just stay the same?
No. The interface, that boundary between the bainite and the austenite, started to change. In the paper, he describes it as degenerating.
Degenerating? That sounds ominous. What does that look like?
It's fascinating. Originally, these bainite plates had smooth, flat interfaces, sharp lines. But after 43 days, looking at the electron micrographs, specifically figure 2 in the source, you see these weird bumps forming. He calls them perturbations.
Bumps. So the smooth edge got wavy.
Yes. And these bumps were fundamentally different from the original bainite. First off, they didn't have that specific shape change, the IPS that the original bainite had. And secondly, they clearly grew via diffusion.
So after the fast reaction stopped because of the carbon, the metal effectively said, fine, if I can't run anymore, I guess I'll start crawling.
That's a perfect analogy. The metal was still trying to transform, but it had to switch mechanisms. It switched from whatever it was doing before to a diffusion-based growth.
But wait, playing devil's advocate here. The fact that bumps appeared later doesn't prove what the original plate was, does it? Maybe the original plate was just fast diffusion, and the bumps are slow diffusion.
That is the exact counterargument he anticipated. And this is where we get to the core of the deep dive. The math. He had to calculate the speed limit to prove they were different mechanisms.
The speed trap.
He used a theory by Mullins and Sikirka. They studied morphological instability, basically the math of how flat interfaces become unstable and bumpy. Padaysia wanted to answer one question. If these bumps are growing by carbon diffusion, how fast should they be growing?
Okay, so we're calculating the theoretical maximum speed of a diffusion-controlled bump at 478 degrees. We're looking for the speed limit of a carbon atom.
Right. He took the diffusion coefficients, accounted for the chromium retarding the process, the carbon activity, the Zener assumption about concentration gradients, all the variables, and he calculated a theoretical growth rate of 9.044 times 10 to the minus 7 meters per second.
9.04 times 10 to the minus 7 meters per second. Okay, that's our calculated max.
Now, he compared that to the actual observed speed, remembering? He knew how big the bumps were, about half a micron, and he knew how long they took to grow 43 days.
And what was the actual speed?
1.4 times 10 to the minus 13 meters per second.
Whoa, hold on. 10 to the minus 7 versus 10 to the minus 13. That is 6 orders of magnitude.
It's a massive discrepancy. The actual bumps grew millions of times slower than even the theoretical maximum for diffusion, and orders of magnitude slower than the original plate.
So the bumps, which we know grew by diffusion, were incredibly painfully slow. They were basically moving in geological time.
Exactly. And here is the aha moment. Think back to the beginning of the experiment. Before the 43 days, when the bainite first formed, how fast did it happen?
You said it was rapid.
Extremely rapid. We're talking about plates shooting across the grain in seconds.
I see the logic now. If the bumps are what diffusion looks like at 478 degrees, and diffusion is practically frozen at that temperature, then the original fast transformation could not have been diffusion.
Bingo. Thermal movement at 478 degrees is just too sluggish to account for the speed of bainite formation. If the bumps, which are definitely diffusional, are that slow, the fast stuff must be something else.
It must be the glider. It must be the military unit.
It has to be. The conclusion is that the interface responsible for bainite transformation must be glycyl. It must be a Martensitic shear-type interface. It's the only mechanism that allows for that kind of speed when diffusion is effectively asleep at the wheel.
That is such a satisfying deductive proof. It's like proving a suspect couldn't have walked to the crime scene because the distance was too great. They must have taken a car. The speed difference gives it away.
Precisely. He isolated the variables by using time. By waiting for the slow process to show its face, he proved that the fast process was entirely different.
Now, I have to ask about the bumps themselves. Why did they form at all? If diffusion is so slow and hard, why did the interface get wavy after 43 days? Why not just stay flat and inch forward?
That connects back to the stored energy. Remember the shape change we talked about, the shear?
Yeah, the strain energy. The metal is under tension.
Right. When the bainite forms by shear, it acts like a loaded spring. It puts the surrounding lattice under immense strain. Thermodynamics dictates that the system wants to minimize that energy. It wants to relax.
Okay, so the metal wants to heal that strain.
To heal it, atoms need to move. They need to diffuse away from high stress areas. But as we established, diffusion is hard. Atoms have to physically travel. Now imagine you are an atom trying to get to the interface to relieve some stress. If the interface is a long, flat wall, you might have to travel a long way to find a spot to settle.
Right. It's a long commute.
But if the interface breaks up into little bumps or perturbations, you change the geometry. You increase the local surface area in a way that minimizes the distance the atoms have to travel to heal that shear strain.
Oh, interesting. So the interface degenerated into bumps to create a shortcut.
In a way, yes. The degeneration was the system's way of making diffusion easier. By breaking up the flat interface, it reduced the diffusion distance needed to eliminate the strain energy.
The metal is lazy. It wants to do the least amount of work possible.
Or efficient. Nature always follows the path of least resistance. In this case, making the interface bumpy, it was the most efficient way to lower the energy state, even though it took 43 days to do it.
That is wild. It really paints a picture of this material as something living, or at least active. It's struggling against its own constraints.
It is. Steel is never just steel. It's a captured moment in a dynamic process.
So let's recap this verdict, because this paper really lays it down.
The verdict is clear. Padeshia concluded that the bainite interface is glycyl. It moves by a coordinated military-style glide. It cannot be diffusion-controlled because, as the 43-day experiment proved, diffusion at that temperature is just too slow.
We started with a block of steel. We cooked it. We waited and waited and waited. We watched the edges get bumpy. We measured the speed of those bumps. And that discrepancy, the difference between the tortoise-like speed of the bumps and the hare-like speed of the bainite, proved the case.
It proved that the original transformation was a displacive shear transformation, not a diffusional scramble.
And why should our listener, maybe someone who just works with steel or is curious about science, care about this distinction? Huh? Why does it matter if it glides or climbs?
It matters because the mechanism dictates the properties. A shear transformation, that violent military glide, introduces a huge number of defects and dislocations into the crystal structure.
And defects sound bad, but in steel?
In steel, defects are strength. Those dislocations impede the movement of other layers, making the material harder and tougher. If bainite formed by diffusion, the slow, messy climb, it would be a much softer, weaker material. The fact that it forms by shear is exactly why bainite is so valuable in high-strength applications.
So the violence of the formation is what gives it its power.
Exactly. The chaos creates the strength.
That is a great takeaway. Before we wrap up, I want to leave you with a thought about time. We live our lives in seconds, minutes, hours. 43 days feels like an eternity to wait for a science experiment.
I can only imagine the lab notes. Day 32, still nothing. Day 33, still nothing.
Right. But in geological time, 43 days is nothing. It's a blink. Yet in the world of atoms at 478 degrees Celsius, 43 days was exactly the right amount of time. It was just enough time to peel back the curtain and reveal the true nature of the interface.
It makes you wonder about the materials we see around us every day. We assume they are stable because they don't change while we look at them.
Maybe they are just changing on a timeline we aren't patient enough to observe.
That's a very real possibility. There are likely many metastable materials that are slowly, slowly evolving, and we just haven't waited 43 days or 43 years to see the bumps form.
It asks us to consider, what other material properties, what other secrets of the universe are hidden right in front of us, simply because we haven't paused long enough to let them show themselves?
That is a very big question. And a humbling one.
Something to mull over. Thanks for joining us on this deep dive into the microscopic slow motion world of bainite.
A pleasure as always.
We'll catch you on the next one. Keep wondering.